I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Now, before we dive into the show today, we wanted to extend a big welcome to our new listeners tuning in to hear us for the very first time from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's good to have you with us. But now let's get right to it. We start today with Haiti, a country struggling in the wake of last week's assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Following the assassination, Haiti's police force has killed at least four people that it suspects in the president's killing and has arrested more than a dozen, including two who Haitian officials say are American citizens. But the reasons for this assassination are still relatively unknown. According to the Miami Herald, in March of this year, polling showed that around 57% of people in Haiti disapproved of Moïse's party, and Moïse had drawn condemnation from global leaders for not holding parliamentary elections at their scheduled time more than a year ago. But despite the instability that characterized much of Moïse's time in office, what comes next could be worse for Haiti's residents. The country is currently under a form of political control similar to martial law. And in the days since the assassination, two different leaders have claimed that they are now serving as Haiti's prime minister. The current interim government has requested assistance from the U.S. military, but thus far, President Biden has resisted, choosing only to send a small team to assess the situation. Now, these current conditions are being closely watched by world leaders, including the Biden administration and the United Nations. But previous intervention by the U.S. and other global powers in Haiti has often had disastrous consequences.
Years since the devastating earthquake that ravaged Haiti. Critics have faulted the efforts of international donors, including the U.S., for failing to deliver on pledges while exerting excessive control over the reconstruction process.
United Nations peacekeepers, there to help, are accused of adding to the harm. A study claims they fathered hundreds of babies, then abandoned the young mothers, some only children themselves.
Last year, Nepalese soldiers under UN command were accused of contaminating water, leading to a deadly cholera outbreak, killing thousands of people.
For more on all of this, we're joined now by Gary Pierre Pierre, founder and editor-in-chief of the Haitian Times. Gary, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And also with us is Francois Pierre-Louis, professor of political science at Queens College at the City University of New York, who specializes in Haitian politics and immigration. Francois, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Melissa.
So, Gary, I want to begin with you. What has been the impact in Haiti in the immediate aftermath of this assassination?
Well, the impact has been a shock from the population. Jovenel was not very popular in Haiti, and I would say that that poll was generous to the reality on the ground. He was deeply unpopular for a host of reasons, but nevertheless, his assassination brought people together because people said, well, as much as we dislike Jovenel, he was our president. And then foreigners came and killed him. So right now, there's a period of mourning. I'm afraid the unknown is, what would the people's reaction be? I think that one of the reasons why the so-called Prime Minister Claude Joseph asked for U.S. intervention because he doesn't know what the reaction of the people would be. And also, more importantly, what the gang leaders' reaction would be if they decide to come together and, God forbid, attack, and it would be total chaos. And so right now, the situation is very fluid. We're assessing what's going on, and we're waiting because there is a mourning period of 15 days, and so we wait.
Francois, as we just heard from Gary there, that reference to the gangs and to gang violence, I don't think we can really even think about this assassination and the responses to it without understanding something about the past few months. Can you walk us through this context a bit?
Well, since Jovenel Moïse became president, there has been a total decline of political order in Haiti in terms of not only the political institutions were dismembered by President Jovenel. He didn't renew the mandate of parliament for new elections. The local officials, all the mayors, were appointed by President Jovenel right after their term ended. And also he fired several members of the Supreme Court. So actually right now you only had 11 people running elected officials in Haiti, with Jovenel Moïse being one of them. Right now, you only have 10 former senators as elected officials in Haiti. So there has been a complete breakdown of the state institutions in Haiti. But one thing I think we should be aware of also, this was an insider job in terms of the killing of President Jovenel Moïse. And there has been a lot of emphasis on the gangs and outside influence, but no one has really spoken about the insider going in inside the bedroom of a president without any shot being, at anyone. No police officers, no security of the president was affected. No one in the security was affected. So therefore, they claim the gangs, they claim outside, but they don't really talk about the breakdown of the institutional process that led to this crisis.
That's so helpful. Gary, can you speak a bit on that? I heard you say in your first response, this sense of outsiders having come in and killed our president, right? Whether we like him or not, that is such an indication of crisis. But we're also hearing from Francois here, this notion of this being in part an insider job and responsibility. Can you speak on that a bit?
The rule of protecting an asset, if you will, is that you're the first to be fired, to be shot at. In this case, no one, according to reports anyway, was shot from the presidential security details. And they went inside his bedroom, which I understand from a credible sources, that room had a door, security door with a code to get in. And that was breached as well. So it brings one to think about, well, this was clearly an inside job, because otherwise, how did this happen? There's a lot of suspicions about who it could have been. We don't know right now at this moment exactly who it is. And, you know, frankly, we may not ever find out, given Haiti's history of dealing with these high profile killings. I mean, we can think about the journalist Jean-Dominique, who was gunned down in front of his radio station more than 20 years ago. Even today, we don't even know who was the culprit. And so we await, hopefully, with the team of FBI agents on the ground in Haiti, they'll be able to piece together what happened and hopefully bring someone to justice.
Francois, you've talked here about the breakdown of these total government systems. We have two different politicians now claiming the title of prime minister. Why is there confusion about who's currently in charge?
Well, a few days before he was assassinated, Jovenel Moïse fired Claude Joseph, who has now claimed to be the prime minister. And then he had a decree out to put in Ariel Henry as a new prime minister. In fact, on Wednesday when he was assassinated, Wednesday morning, on that very same day, he was going to install Ariel Henry. Ariel Henry was supposed to take the oath of office at that time. So technically, Claude Joseph is not the legitimate prime minister. And officially, Henry is not the legitimate prime minister either. So therefore, you really have a real power vacuum there, because there's no one at any level of government that can replace Jovenel Moïse. And since no one expected him to die so suddenly, and his intention was really to turn upside down on the state institutions by revamping the constitution, writing a new one, putting in an intelligence service, by trying to dispossess many of the members of the business class. So therefore, you have total chaos right now. And the fact that he was relying on the gangs to control and suppress the population and push in his agenda, you really have what you really have right now are the gangs are the ones that have the power in Haiti.
Okay. So that language of the total chaos and the actual deployment, the use of gangs rather than of what we might think of as sort of a state police force to keep law and order, even in a what one might call a dictatorship. Just, Gary, can you put that in context, that sense of total chaos, together with the COVID-19 crisis on the island? Because Haiti does not have access to vaccines. The numbers are going up and are likely underreported. How is the coronavirus also impacting this sense of total chaos?
Well, the Delta variant has been wreaking havoc on Haiti right now. As you mentioned correctly, we've been getting underreported numbers. And it is within that climate that Haiti is dealing with the constitutional crisis that's going on top of a security crisis, on top of a social and economic crisis. And again, the unknown here, the unknown factor, as Francois said, are the gangs, because the gangs have been the de facto running Haiti. They decide when people can come out, when people can have to stay in. They dictate the terms of law. They are the rule of law. And in fact, the police have tried many times to try to infiltrate and try to dismantle the gangs with very botched results. Just a few months ago, they tried to go into a gang stronghold in a neighborhood called Village de Dieu. And Dieu means God. And God was not with the police at the time because they were basically massacred. And they had tanks that were confiscated by the gang members that reportedly the government had to pay the gangs to retrieve these tanks. And frankly, what Francois said is correct. Total chaos. Why? The reason that we are not seeing that yet is because there hasn't been any street protests, violent protests or so. But rest assured, there is no one in charge right now in Haiti. Despite what the UN may tell us that it's Claude Joseph who's prime minister, well, no, he's not. He was fired. The Ariel Henry's nomination was published in a Monitor. The Monitor is the official publication of the Haitian government. Once something is published in the Monitor, it's official. The fact that he was not sworn in is purely ceremonial. So therefore, you know, Henry legally should be the prime minister, but the UN has decided that Claude Joseph is their guy and they're going to go with him for better or for worse.
Francois, I want to talk a little bit about the request for U.S. troops. I think for me, as I hear the request, on the one hand, I understand our sense of geopolitical and humanitarian interest in what is happening, but I also cannot help but to think about 1994's Operation Uphold Democracy, which restored Aristide to power, but did not make circumstances in the long term better in Haiti. What are your thoughts about U.S. intervention in this moment?
I think sending U.S. troops to Haiti would be a total mistake for several reasons. First, what is happening right now? The narrative is being pushed and promoted by members of the same group that supported Moïse and that are still in relationship with members of PHTK, which is the political party of Moïse. And what they're trying to do is having the U.S. troops come in to protect them from different situations in Haiti. That would be a grave mistake. Secondly, the narrative also is excluding many of the democratic organizations in Haiti, the grassroots groups, the groups that have been fighting against corruption, the groups that have held, Moïse to be accountable to the expenses of the Petro-Caribe funds that he had squandered. He himself took money from those funds when he was a private businessman. And third, all the summary killings and the massacres that have taken place in Haiti under his administration. So what they're hoping to do is to bring the Marines back to Haiti to protect these people so that impunity continues in Haiti. And I think the biggest mistake the UN has made, and sometimes the US, is to exclude those organizations, those individuals, those groups such as the church the members of the Protestant and Catholic Church, the grassroots organizations, the students, the unions. In fact, 95% of the population that are represented by these organizations are excluded from the discourse right now. So therefore, that's why if the U.S. comes in, it would be reinforcing the status quo that has put Haiti in this situation currently.
So, Gary, I'm wondering about ways that the U.S. and or the U.N. might be able to leverage its power or its relationships in Haiti in such a way that actually do elevate the voices and the capacity for exactly those organizations and individuals who are Haitian society in the ways that Francois just laid out for us.
Well, I think I agree with Francois, absolutely. There's no need for U.S. military intervention, but I think there is room for U.S. intervention in terms diplomatically, politically. I've been urging the White House to really look at a different approach. We need to engage the Haitian American community. I've written a column, outlined some of the folks that I think are in a position to really lead such a Haiti task force. Because Haitian Americans the real stakeholders in this crisis. We have friends or family back home. Haitian Americans send more than $2 billion annually back home in remittances. And so in the past, they've been ignored, largely put in aside. We've been spectators. I think right now we need to be players in this situation because everything that's been talked about has been tried and has failed. We need to push the reset button and look at, okay, how can we actually get this right this time? The civil society members that Francois has spoken about are never engaged by the powers that be in Washington or the UN, even the Organization of American States. When they come in, they just speak with what they think are the important people in the government in the private sector, and they ignored the civil society, which, as you all know, is what is the backbone of any society.
That story of ignoring civil society and grassroots leaders and organizations in order to just speak with who is perceived as important. I mean, I just spent the week in New Orleans, and that language describes to me so much of what happened in my beloved city immediately following the Hurricane Katrina disaster. I'm wondering, and Francois, maybe you can weigh in on this, as Gary is talking about this connection with Haitian Americans, with stakeholders here in the States, there's also this issue of Haitian immigrants who have temporary protected status. I'm wondering sort of where the Biden administration is standing on the extension of that program. I know there's been extension, but whether or not people are still being deported, particularly back into an island that is in this kind of chaos.
In fact, yes. As of last week, there was a number of people were deported back to Haiti. The program has not ended yet. And sending people back to Haiti in this chaotic situation is really inhuman in that sense. But the other thing I would add to what Gary mentioned is the burden of the Haitian diaspora, Haitian Americans, in terms of economic, social, and political, on their relatives back home. Whenever Haiti is in a crisis, Haitians in the diaspora, primarily in the United States, have to send more money back home to support their children, their family members, and their friends. So as a result, economically, it impoverished the Haitian Americans in the United States. Therefore, it is in the interest of the American government and other governments where you have large Haitian residents to try to take care of the situation in Haiti, because that would alleviate the burden of their own Haitian Americans and other nationals. The other thing also, I believe that it would be impossible for the Biden administration to handle the number of refugees that will be coming. They may not be land on the shore of Miami, but they're definitely going to be on Guantanamo Bay or some parts of the Caribbean.
François Pierre-Louis is a professor of political science at Queens College at the City University of New York. And Gary Pierre-Pierre is the founder and editor-in-chief of the Haitian Times. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
So how are Haitians in the U.S. processing the news? Last Friday, we spoke to three people deeply connected to the island to get their reactions to the situation.
My name is Rico Dupree. I'm the station director at Radio Soleil. That's a 24-hour Haitian radio station here based in Brooklyn.
My name is Marlène Bastien, and I'm the executive director of Family Action Network Movement, FAM. I was born in Haiti, but I've been living here for the past 40 years.
Paul Christian Nanfi, lead organizer of the Family Action Network Movement, and I'm a person of Haitian origin.
It was not until 5:30 in the morning that I heard something that sounded like a phone call.
I heard the news about the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse while I was getting ready to go for my morning walk.
And I got up and I said, my goodness, I saw over 25 to 30 phone calls.
My home phone was ringing off the hook at the same time with my cell phone. And usually when that happens, that means something horrible is happening.
So I woke up, I was working on revising a document, and then, you know, there were people in my house, including one of my sons, who were saying, you know, Jovenel Moïse has been killed. You know, the former president of Haiti has been killed.
When I received the call, she informed me that President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated. I was really shocked.
I was shocked.
This was a shock. I got on whatever media I could, you know, NPR, CNN, the internet, you know, to figure out what information can we get. Because there were reports also that the First Lady had been killed. And so, you know, this was always, oftentimes we say in Haiti, the truth is worth more than gold. So we were seeking to get to the bottom of exactly what was happening. As details of what has happened has emerged, it's become very, very clear that this is a very, very gruesome, brutal act that happened, which was not an act in isolation, but which follows many, many, many other murders. We've had massacres going on in Haiti since the last week of June until the present, where, you know, many dynamic, you know, feminist leaders, journalists, many people have been killed by death squads and by armed gangs in really horrible fashion. So this is just something that, as details emerge, it becomes more and more worrying for us.
I'm a fierce critic of the regime of Jovenel Moïse, the deceased president. That is well known, not only of himself, but of his regime, the whole PHTK regime. Definitely we deplore his death, the way he was killed. That's not what we wanted. We wanted him to cede power and to avail himself for the justice system to examine his actions and have him pay for the countless crimes that he committed in the country.
Whether you were part of the majority, from the civil society, from the opposition groups, from the religious sectors, business sectors who have been organizing against him, or whether you were part of the minority that supported him, right? It is shocking. It is shocking for a sitting president to be assassinated in his own home, and his wife shot three times while his children were in the house. So whether you were for him or against him, whether you agreed with President Jovenel Moïse's politics or not, the fact that he could be assassinated in his own home highlights the high level of instability and violence that permeated the island over the past few months.
My youngest daughter is in Haiti right now. It's a cause of concern, but she's not in Port-au-Prince right now. So that's really a source of relief, although we are still in a situation of uncertainty because she's in school here in Miami-Dade County. And it's very important for us to for us to get her back. And because of the closing of the border, the closing of flights, you know, it's been a very, very, very fluid and uncertain situation about logistically how we can even get her back to school, because we just don't know what's going to happen next, how long this is going to be going on. We don't know.
I still have most of my family in Haiti. I have a lot of aunts, cousins and uncles, and there is a lot of confusion there now. People are very scared and concerned that this could degenerate into more violence, because as I indicated, leading to this, a lot of people have been forced out of their homes because armed gangs have been wreaking havoc in people's lives, kidnapping people, kidnapping women and girls, because in times of high level of political instability and violence, women and girls usually fare worse. And for the past few months, the Haitian women and Haitian girls have been kidnapped, raped and killed and thrown on piles of trash. The situation has been chaotic, to speak mildly. But the people of Haiti now, they are very concerned that this could get worse. And given what they've been through for the past few months, you can understand that they are very scared. There is an state of siege in the nation. A lot of them are confused about that. The airport is closed. The police has occupied the streets. So people are scared.
What we want for Haiti is what everyone wants for the country. It's to really allow democracy to flourish. And when we talk democracy, what does it mean? It simply means allow people to choose who's going to lead them. And that has been denied Haitians, the country, for years.
My message to our brothers and sisters now is that, yes, yeah, we know you've been yearning for peace. You've been yearning for security. But now, with this crisis, there is a possibility to do it. But we have to unite. You have to unite your strength. You have to unite your voices and create a space for every voice to be represented and to come out with a short-term and long-term strategy to move this beautiful, beautiful island nation forward. Haiti will not die. Haiti will rise. Haiti will rise. But we are asking our friends to let Haiti leave and to heed the voices of the Haitian people, because after all, they are the masters of their own destiny.
The voices there are of Marlene Bastien, Rico Dupuy, and Paul Christian Nomfi, speaking about Haiti.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega.
Here comes Shaqiri! Richardson's going to Tokyo! 1087!
And we're listening to the moment when 21-year-old Shaqiri Richardson won the women's 100-meter race at the U.S. track and field trials last month. Her emotions were intense.
Unbelievable. The fact that I am an Olympian, no matter what is said or anything, I am an Olympian. A dream since I've been young.
Richardson's dream ended abruptly last week after she tested positive for marijuana, was banned from competition for 30 days, and was not added to the roster of athletes who will compete in the Olympics this month. She made no excuses, but the heartbreak was evident.
I want to take responsibility for my actions. I know what I did. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm allowed not to do, and I still made that decision.
Here's how President Biden responded when he was asked about the fairness of banning Richardson from Olympic competition.
It's the rules are the rules, and everybody knows that the rules we're going in. Whether they should remain that should remain the rules, a different issue.
The rules are the rules, and everybody knew the rules going in, but did we? Nearly a decade before Richardson was born, Bill Clinton was elected president, just months after saying this.
I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale, and never tried it again.
The year Richardson was born, George W. Bush was elected president.
I didn't behave that well when I was younger.
Yeah.
And, like I might have smoked some, for example.
When Richardson was in high school, President Bush's big brother, Governor Jeb Bush, ran for president as a Republican.
So 40 years ago, I smoked marijuana, and I admit it. I'm sure that other people might have done it and may not want to say it in front of 25 million people. My mom's not happy that I just did.
And that same year, Senator Bernie Sanders ran for the Democratic presidential nomination.
You know, I smoked marijuana a couple of times. Didn't do much for me.
During the years when Richardson was in second grade until she was a high school junior, President Obama lived in the White House.
I like Bernie. Bernie's an interesting guy. Apparently, some folks really want to see a pot-smoking socialist in the White House. We could get a third Obama term after all.
Last year, when Richardson was still just 20 years old, America elected its first black woman vice president, Kamala Harris.
Have you ever smoked?
I have.
Okay.
I inhaled. I did inhale. It was a long time ago.
Now, don't misunderstand me. This is not a finger-wagging respectability diatribe. I'm not here to rail against elected officials setting a bad example and corrupting America's youth. I'm here to ask a question because I'm genuinely curious. When President Biden says,
"The rules are the rules, and everybody knows that the rules we're going in."
See, I'm left asking, what are the rules that we all know? For Sha'Carri Richardson's entire life, marijuana has posed no barrier to representing the nation at its highest and most visible level. Democrats and Republicans, black and white, men and a woman, all have disclosed their dalliance with weed and been met with laughter, applause, a wink of recognition, a nod of knowing. For Richardson, it seems the rules are different.
When you stand just 5 feet, 1 inch tall, you get told your entire life what you cannot do. That chip on her shoulder is because every time she's been told that, she's been able to overcome those odds and get it done. The United States women have not won the Olympic gold in this event since 1996. So it's going to take somebody who is audacious and bold and brash to get the United States back on the top.
And we're listening to some analysis offered by an NBC sports announcer at the Olympic trials in June. Just weeks later, Richardson's bold, brash, audacious willingness to get it done and overcome all odds was being denigrated rather than celebrated. It turned out that in order to overcome the emotional devastation of losing her mother and the tremendous pressure of the Olympic trials, Richardson needed a little weed to take the edge off. Now, recreational marijuana is legal in 19 states, D.C. and Guam, but it remains a banned substance for Olympic athletes. Do the rules need to change for Olympians? Do the laws need to change for everyone? Are the barriers medical, political, cultural? Why do we openly pop bottles of champagne after a hard-earned victory, but clutch our pearls at the thought of puffing and passing to celebrate a win? For more on this, I'm now joined by Professor Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies at Penn State University. She's also co-host of the podcast, Burn It All Down. Welcome, Amira.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
And Jason Williamson, the Executive Director of the Center on Race, Inequality, and Law at NYU Law School. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thank you both for being here. Amir, I want to start with you. I want to just take one more beat and listen to something that Sha'Carri said.
Don't judge me because I am human. I'm you. I just happen to run a little faster.
So she has taken full responsibility. She has, you know, but she is in that moment saying, please don't judge me. Can you weigh in on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think her tweet, "I am human," speaks so voluminous, because the lack of empathy for the reasoning that she's bringing to the table, for what she's saying, right? I found out that my mother passed away. And that is grief. That is pain. And if you only can see me as a one-dimensional athlete and you can't see the rest of this, right, including mistakes or decisions or reasons behind decisions, then you're not seeing my full humanity. And I think it echoes and reverberates at a time where other Black women athletes are saying the same thing. You're not seeing me as fully human. Why am I needing to, you know, completely perform all of my traumas to get anybody to care? And if that means I mess up or break a rule or whatever, I'm accepting of that because this is all me. And I think that is what she's insisting upon over and over and over again since this has come out, that I'm human above all else, and this is the decision I made, and this is my grief that nobody seems to want to actually account for.
So, Jason, I want to build on that, because I'm wondering if it's even necessary to go to a place of grief, of mistakes, of distress, although certainly that is at the core of how Sha'Carri is talking about this herself. But I mean, as we talked about kind of at the front of all this, I mean, people just smoke weed because, well, people smoke weed in the same ways that folks have a beer after a long run. I'm just wondering about whether what's going on here is a sort of requirement for a higher level of moral, you know, sort of moral reasoning.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think so. First of all, I just want to agree with both you and Professor Davis that, you know, I think Sha'Carri has handled this situation with tremendous grace in a very difficult situation. So I give her all the credit in the world. And it's really all of us who are having conversations about whether or not this is fair. But I mean, the truth is that this is not happening in a vacuum, right? This is, yes, in some ways about Sha'Carri, but it's also happening in the context of a significant shift in public opinion about marijuana, or at least what people are willing to share in public about their feelings around marijuana. As you mentioned in your opening, 19 states have now legalized the marijuana. And so I think people understanding that and kind of seeing this shift in the way that people are thinking and talking about it, there's a dissonance between that and now punishing this athlete and not allowing her to achieve her goal. And I also think, you know, President Biden mentioned that rules are rules, and sure, I suppose that's true, just like laws are laws. The problem is that those laws, including and in particular marijuana laws, have not been historically enforced in a proportionate way, right? They're being enforced disproportionately in communities of color, even though the law is supposed to apply evenly to everyone. And as you said, Black, white, brown, yellow, a bunch of people are smoking on a daily basis and not feeling the same consequences as Black and brown folks, particularly in low-income neighborhoods.
So let me come to you, Amira, on exactly that point. Should we be thinking about the world of sport quite differently, you know, relative to this sort of war on drugs? Is this is this question less about race and the inequities of the war on drugs, and more just about the Olympics being a special set aside space?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's completely intertwined, right? So when you talk about the Clinton administration, you talk about the war on drugs, one of the things that they really targeted in the late 90s was pushing for marijuana to be part of this comprehensive anti-drug program that they wanted the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, to adapt. And part of that was through this idea that like athletes had to be role models. And while they're saying athletes, and that's like all athletes, yes, specifically when you're talking about the way the United States exports Black athletic labor, there is certainly a racialized element to it in demanding and over-policing weed, drugs, regardless of it's at the Olympic level or in LA or in New York or wherever. And so I don't think we can actually disentangle the two. But certainly this kind of romanticism about the Olympics is tied up in making it feel like this special drug-free space.
So talking about this dynamic where Black women like Sha'Carri and even Naomi Osaka, who we talked about earlier in the summer, are talking about taking care of themselves, is that a kind of revolutionary moment?
Yeah, I think that their staying power and the way that it is happening all together and kind of building and keeping the conversation front and center is really important. I feel like when we talked about Naomi a few weeks ago, it was sense like, okay, now the subject to kind of move on. But when people like Sha'Carri are continuing to add to it, when Gwen is adding to it, when Anna Cockrell, when Breonna McNeil, when all these Black women athletes are saying, here is my mental health and it matters. When Simone Manuel says it's been a burden to be a Black woman, this past year and overtraining and the stress of the Olympics, and that's why I took time away from the pool, that matters to say publicly. And I think that it is inspiring and creating a kind of larger space for this consideration of not just Black women's mental health, but mental health for all athletes, and not just athletes who are Black women, but Black women in general, right? Therapy for Black girls is part of this fuller, robust conversation happening around mental health needs. And I think that Black women are absolutely pushing that forward in whatever self-care may look like, whether it's absence, whether it like Naomi, whether it's insisting on kind of full humanity, whether it's other forms of self-care that they're leaning into quite publicly. I think it's definitely a kind of new, refreshing, much louder conversation than it's been before.
So Jason, I want to continue to follow up on this kind of self-care aspect. And I don't want to suggest that the use of controlled substances, you know, whether we're talking about too many glasses of wine in the evening or whether, you know, we're talking about the use of marijuana or vaping or any of those things, whether legal or illegal. But I am interested in whether or not in this moment, this sort of leadership about that need to care for ourselves and the fact that some of us do kind of rest in a little bit to some substances to help us feel better. Is this a way to maybe break through some of this anxiety, kind of cultural anxiety we have about marijuana use?
I hope so. And I think Black women athletes in particular should be applauded for the leadership that they're showing in that regard. And I think part of why the conversation is louder, as Professor Davis noted, is that you have prominent female athletes, Black women, speaking out publicly about all of this and insisting on taking time out to take care of themselves, whatever that may look like. And then I think you see a cultural shift that we talked about earlier that has led to so many states starting to legalize not just medical marijuana, but recreational marijuana as well, and not just in places like California or Colorado or Oregon, where the argument has largely been about, you know, the freedom to put things in our bodies without the government telling us what to do, but also now in places like New York and New Jersey and Washington, D.C., where it's one, more conversation about racial justice and the need to take a more fair and balanced approach to marijuana and marijuana enforcement and so on, and changing the way that we think about these things. As President Biden mentioned, he said sort of in a throwaway line that not only that rules are rules, but that there's a separate question about whether those rules should remain in place. And I think that's precisely the conversation that we need to make sure we have. And there's no question that Black women athletes speaking out about this is doing a lot to push that ball forward.
Although, Jason, it's worth pointing out that it's hard to kind of take care of yourself if you are incarcerated as a result of older marijuana laws, right, sort of before this shift began to happen, or even if you're no longer incarcerated, you know, if you can't benefit from those changing laws, right, economically, fiscally, because you have this, you know, prior arrest and incarceration, if we're really talking about folks being able to take care of themselves, how can we also shift those laws so that as states begin to open up, everybody has a right to enter into that marketplace?
I think that's exactly right. And that's why the framing of the issue in places like Washington, D.C. Was really about ensuring not only that we're going to destigmatize and decriminalize the use of marijuana, but also that we're going to allow people and communities of color who have been burdened by this for so many years to benefit from the change in the law, either as participants in the market or at the very least being able to enjoy the law itself without, being harassed by the police. You know, it is true that even in states where marijuana has been decriminalized, such that, you know, people aren't being arrested for it, but are just being cited, you still have Black and brown folks being cited more often than white people in those jurisdictions. So, those inequities still exist, and we have a long way to go, to your point. But my hope is that as we're talking about this in a different way, that people will start to understand the equity issues in allowing people to feel the full benefit of this cultural shift.
So, Amir, it feels to me like that over-policing of Black folk, of poor folk, of Latino folks is precisely related to this desire to discredit, right, Sha'Carri, not only on the question, the fact that she did use marijuana, but also these other ways to discredit her. What have we been seeing on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's important to note on the vote Jason just made about these laws and the length of time it takes to, you know, actually have that felt on the ground. It's oftentimes too little too late, whether you're talking about people who are incarcerated while people are making absolute bank on, you know, marijuana industries, or you're talking about athletes like Sha'Carri, right, where in many other sports we've seen a relaxation of weed, whether they're changing the amount that they're testing for or the last CBA for the NBA, for instance, they're not going to do random drug tests. We've seen it relaxed in other areas. I think that we talked about the Olympics as this kind of special little space that has had made it more durable there. But I think that you also see this kind of throwing up of the hands, right, where it's like, oh, we can't do anything about this, when that's actually not true. And I think that when you read that in, right, the decision to keep her off the 4x100 team, for instance, where the statement that was put out was that they empathize with her and they want to support her, but they also feel like everybody abided by the rules, and because she didn't, she is not eligible for the relay pool, and that they can't bend the rules to accommodate her. And my question would be, well, what rule were they thinking they're going to bend? Because the rule state is a 30-day suspension, which she would have served. The rules discredit her 100-meter semi and final, but that has nothing to do with the relay pool. In fact, that's been a place of discretion. That's been a place where people have been able to appoint people who are dealing with grief and maybe did not put up good times, who had maybe an injury but would be good. We've seen this kind of discretion go in favor of other athletes many times. And so I think that, for instance, feels like one of these curious over-policing, over-scrutinized decisions that continues this kind of stigma that really layers it on, when there was other decisions that could be made. And when you add that into this larger conversation, whether it's about Black women, especially from the Global South, being tested and scrutinized around their chromosomes, think Caster, right? We've seen at least three other athletes barred from the Olympics this cycle as well. When you're talking about the Afro swim cap, the soul cap, when you're talking about things like Simone Biles, right, who has her gymnastic federation intentionally scoring her events lower because they don't want to encourage other people to do them, this idea that Black women athletes in particular are still the site that can be over-scrutinized or policed or stigmatized or whatever. They're very visible symbols, but in many ways, they get made into two-dimensional things that get wielded as battering rams in these kind of cultural debates. And that's why I return to what Sha'Carri said, I am human. And one of the things that I think they are very clear at, whether they're talking about mental health or protesting or whatever, is that you need to see us as fully human so we can actually see how we're still impacted by these institutions, even if the discourse is changing around us, even if it looks like change is on the horizon. If it's not being felt by us yet, we're very much the canary in the minefield. And there is still some work to be done.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State University, also co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. Jason Williamson is the executive director of the Center on Race, Inequality, and the Law at NYU Law School. Thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
It's been so good to be here with y'all today, and we're happy that you spent part of your day with us. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or record a voice memo and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Make your voice part of this show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.